That's the end of the first half. As the teams head to the locker room, the Spartans lead the Bulldogs by a score.
You guys stink.
Jeez, Coach, we're only down a couple of points.
No, I mean you guys really smell. You need to hit the showers. And here, I got every one of you new bars of soap from the Sterling Soap Company. Each bar is artisan crafted using natural ingredients and essential oils. They also have shave soaps, colognes, beard balm, and a whole lot more. Now get in there.
But Coach, we have another half to play.
I don't care. I can't stand to be around you.
A few minutes later.
All right, bring it in tight. You guys are still playing terrible, but you're smelling great out there. Now listen, you're going to need to stock up for the rest of the season. We got a lot of tough games left. So go to sterlingsoap.com after the game. That's S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G soap.com. You got that?
Yes, Coach.
Great. sterlingsoap.com on three. One, two, three.
sterlingsoap.com.
And we'd like to welcome everybody back to the Football's Family Podcast. And in this show, I get to hear a lot of things that just makes football family or sports or anything else family. And sometimes I hear things that I know, and then other times I hear things that I've never even thought about. And today's guest has one of those stories that I am looking forward to hearing. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, thanks, Jeremy. My name is Hank Gola. I wrote a book called City of Champions, and it details the 1939 National Championship of High School Football. And I'm sure everyone out there, 99% of you aren't even aware that it was a national championship game of high school football. But it was played in 1939, Christmas night in the Orange Bowl, and my alma mater, Garfield High School out of New Jersey, defeated Miami High School of obviously in Florida on a field goal with 2 minutes left in the game. It was Benny Babula was the guy who kicked it. Heck of a name for a football player.
Well, it sounds like he's from New Jersey is what it sounds
like. Well, half the team. The thing is that Garfield, of course, was a team of second generation immigrant sons. And half the team was Polish and Eastern European. The other half was Italian. Those were the two sections of town. I was on Michael Kay's radio show. He's the voice of the Yankees, but he had a show on Yes and ESPN Radio. And he asked me to describe Garfield. I said, "Well, there's two sides of town. You've got Guinea Heights and Pollock Valley." There was 10 seconds of silence on the other end, but that kind of describes Garfield. And it was a thing where, you know, everybody needled each other. I mean, I went to high school there and graduated in 72, but everybody came together at the same time. In our high school, at the last gym class of the year, Coach John Hollis, who was an assistant coach on that 39 team, would bring out a big rope and he'd say, "Okay, Guinea's over here, Pollock's over there," and he'd have a tug of war. Everybody looked, and there was a spare German here or there. So they, you know, you just, okay, get over there with the Italians. But it was a special time in American history because I not only talk about the game, but I put it against the backdrop of the country coming out of the Depression and going into World War II. And then I follow all these guys, nearly every one of them went into service. So I follow them into World War II and their lives beyond there. I'm very proud of the book. It got great reviews. I wish we just sold a few more copies. But if you're a fan of football or high school sports, or you don't even have to be a fan of sports at all because there's so much non-sports in there, that I would love you to get it. I think you'd enjoy it.
Well, you were talking about how Eastern European in the 30s, second generation, but many of them probably have immigrated because of what was going on in Nazi Germany or in fascist Italy. And with Poland being involved, they were on the brink of being invaded as well from Russia, from Stalin. 1939, they were actually invaded. I believe it's September 1st, if I remember the correct date.
Right around the start of the high school football season.
So they probably, if you're talking about Garfield, and if I remember my history correctly, that's named after the president, James Garfield. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Yep. So you had Italians, you had Polish, you had Germans who were probably torn by their home country. If not them, then their parents were. And they still won a national championship down in Florida. That tells you a lot about the people that you're writing about.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it was the greatest generation for a reason. And once they moved here, very few of them looked back. It was once they moved, and it was most of the people came over during the World War II years or earlier in the century, not necessarily in the 30s. But once they came over here, many of them never even had contact with their families anymore. They certainly didn't see their mothers and fathers anymore. So they were making a fresh start, and they were very, very determined to raise their kids as Americans. So while these kids grew up maybe speaking the language, the mother tongue of their parents, they were also getting involved in American sports and everything else going on with teenagers in the country at the time, jitterbugging, what have you. It was, like I said, it was a very special time in American history. And I think these guys took what they learned on the football field onto the battlefield. A few of them had some, were involved in some heroics in World War II as well.
I'm
So.
just wondering how, if they had to separate themselves from the place where they grew up, how people viewed them. You know, Polish people might have been a little different because they were the ones who were invaded. But how would people, and maybe you mentioned this in your book, how were people of Italian descent treated in New Jersey in 1939?
Pretty good because there were so many of
Well, so it wasn't a big deal. They weren't in the minority,
them.
huh?
There was a great Italian migration here, and the reason said, well, first of all, the reason people settled in Garfield was because of the woolen mills. Forstmann Woolens in Garfield. There were Botany Village across the river, Botany Woolens Worsted across the Miller River and Passaic. So that drew the immigrants to Garfield and surrounding communities to work in the factories. The Italians settled where they did, and again, I don't want to offend anybody, but there was Guinea Heights and Pohlock Valley. So the Italians settled in the Heights because it reminded them of back home in Italy. And the Eastern Europeans mostly settled in the valley down, and all these guys. The thing was, too, you were identified by where you worshipped and where you drank, because you had three churches in Garfield at the time, three Catholic churches in Garfield that were. One was Italian, Mount Virgin. The other one was Polish, St. Stan's. And then there was one holy name for everybody else. But there was also a Slovak church, a Luther Slovak Lutheran church. There was a Russian Orthodox church. There were certain denominations of Protestant churches. But everybody went. It seemed like it was a time when everybody went to church on Sunday. And for the men coming out of the factories, you want to get a little pop on your way home. So the taverns thrived too. Garfield wasn't a very big place, but at the time there were 52 taverns and saloons on street corners. So they got a lot of
52.
business.
52. Good gracious.
52, yeah.
You know what's funny about that? I was in El Salvador a few years ago on a mission trip, and they had an American bar there. I didn't go to that one in particular, but I walked by it, and they had American sports on, and it was just a way to draw people in. So I imagine each of the men that came out of that had people that they drew in and just probably talk baseball and talked sports as well, when you think.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the crowd, the football team had a huge following, but then that was true of the time, because the NFL was yet to be really established. College football was big, but not everywhere. Certainly not in New Jersey
Well,
and the Northeast.
in New Jersey, would it have been Rutgers?
It would have been Rutgers, yeah, or Fordham at New
Fordham.
York. fell over to Fordham. Fordham was highly ranked at the time. In fact, Babula, who was the star of the Garfield team, ended up playing at Fordham. But I mean, high school football was huge, so especially if you had a team as good as Garfield or Passaic next door. There were several teams in New Jersey that could have gone down to Florida and given Miami a game, which is interesting now because I mean, some of the best football, high school football talent in the country comes out of Florida. Back then, Miami had a hard time finding competition in Florida. They actually went out of state. They played most of their games against out of state teams like well, Mobile, Alabama, Knoxville, Tennessee, and then they would actually go scout these teams too. They always came to the Orange Bowl because it was a big thing for them to come to make a trip to Florida and play in the Orange Bowl. So Miami hosted most of their games. They didn't play a lot of games on the road.
I can't imagine. I can't imagine kids from New Jersey hopping on some trains, heading down probably to Virginia, and then to down the coast like that. That had to have been something.
Yeah, they took a train ride from Newark Airport. I mean, Newark Penn Station. There were 10,000 people in Newark to see them off, and the governor of New Jersey was there at the station, but the crowd prevented him from getting to the right platform. So he was a couple of platforms over trying to make his speech and shout it over. Most of these kids had never been out of the state. A few of them been to New York, but most of them were just basically living in Garfield their whole life. So when the train made its first stop in Philadelphia, somebody asked if they were in Florida yet. And at the end of the trip, when they got to Florida and the station in Miami, they were greeted by marching bands and Miami High School co-eds. Miami brought out a lot of co-eds and they assigned them to the players to kind of act as ambassadors. And they ended up staying at the Alcatraz Hotel. Alcatraz, I'm sorry, Alcatraz was out of my mouth. The Alcazar Hotel in on Biscayne Boulevard, which was a luxury luxury hotel at the time. That's where they put up for the duration of their stay in Miami. And for many of them, it was the greatest thing. You know, at the time, the greatest event of their lives and something that they always remember for
And
sure.
within 2 years, many of them are in the Pacific or in Europe.
Absolutely. Benny Babula, for instance, was on a PT boat and he got a couple of Purple Hearts. Davey Eldridge, who was the star of the Miami team, was joined the Navy and he was in the. He was a pilot. I'm sorry about that. He was a pilot in the Navy. There was a guy who was shot down, Jack Boyle. He was the starting guard for the Garfield team as they were kind of bombarding Okinawa in the days before that invasion. He was shot down and luckily was not picked up by the Japanese. Otherwise, he would have been a prisoner of war and probably not survived the war. So he was picked up by a U.S. destroyer. And ended up surviving the war, winning a couple of air medals for sure, and then came home and started a family, and they had nine kids. So that was kind of a neat story as well.
Did you get to talk to any of these men for the book,
There
or
were only a
they
couple that
passed?
were survived that had survived. It was one of them was probably one of the finest men I've ever met. His name was Walter Young. And he became a very an engineer, and also he was a member of the New Apostolic Church. So his mother had something to say about him playing on Christmas, but eventually they smoothed that one out. But he became a priest in the New Apostolic Church, and I went to the funeral. Unfortunately, passed away. He didn't see the book. But he did see the article that the book was inspired by. I wrote a story for the New York Daily News where I worked on the game, and that led to the book. He did see that. And very touching for me as well was he ended up with colon cancer. And he called me up and he told me about it. And I said, I'm so sorry. He says, don't be sorry for me. You know, I've lived a great life and all of this. And he was in hospice, and I finished the first chapter of the book, and he was in and out of consciousness. And his son, I sent it to his son, and his son read him the first chapter of the book. I'm hoping that he absorbed some of that because I mean he was so such a terrific guy and deserved it. The interesting thing about Walter too is that Garfield scored the key touchdown of the game on a naked reverse. And he had the key block on the naked river. He had to take care of the fastest guy in the Miami team, Davey Eldridge, and block him in the end zone. And the first time I met him, he said, and it was 75 years at the time. He says, "It's always haunted me. I thought that perhaps it was an illegal block that I clipped him and that I got away with a penalty, and that we won the game unfairly." And I said, "Well, Walter, you know that there are game films. There's a game film of this on the internet." And the day after Thanksgiving that year, I brought my laptop there, and it's in black and white, but most every play is there. So we're watching and watching it. And I said, "Yeah." He says, "It's coming up." And I said, "Yeah." So the play, you could see the play develop, and sure enough, you see the block, you can see the block, and it was clean. And so was Walter's conscience at that point, so he could rest easy that he had not won the game unfairly. It was kind of a neat little moment. And that's actually the first chapter of my book is that, and how that leads into the rest of it.
I'll tell you what, I got a couple questions for you, and Hank and I were talking just a little bit ago. I have a lung infection right now, so I'm having trouble talking. Got a couple questions for you, three actually. Number one, where can we get your book?
Well, it's still on Amazon or any other Barnes and Noble, anyone that sells it online. It's in a lot of libraries across the country. You could check the catalogs, but it's scattered across the country pretty well.
We're going to put the link. I'm going to find the link and put it on my show notes so people can see it, my friend.
Oh, that would be great. And then
Absolutely.
probably it's in a few bookstores. Probably not. I think it's in more used bookstores than new bookstores, because I wrote this in 2018, so it's been a while.
Oh, okay. Well, it
Yeah.
does, we get it out there still.
Yeah, it's still for sale. You can still buy it.
Now, I'm looking behind you and you have a Giants helmet.
Oh, I
Oh,
covered the
yeah.
Giants.
That's one of the
I was a
things
beat
that
writer for the Giants,
that's
and
one of the things, Hank, that I like. If you look behind me, I got a lot of mess, but this stuff I like. I got my tights, which makes me sicker than I am. I've got Indiana Jones that makes me feel good. And then I got my daughters that make me feel good and sick at the same time. Just depends on the day. Who's your favorite Giant of all time?
Well, okay, let me explain. I covered the Giants. So
Okay.
when I retired, when actually the Daily News laid me off, there was this big purge in 2015, and they laid off about 15 people, cut the staff to nothing. And they stopped covering things like golf. And at my retirement party, John Mara, the owner of the Giants, presented. No, we're not on video, so I can't show it. Presented me with a helmet that was signed by Eli Manning, Tom Coughlin, and the general manager. Yeah, that's kind of cool. I'm not really a Giants fan because I really don't have any team. I didn't feel like, I was a Browns fan when I was growing up, but I didn't feel like it, I wanted to remain unbiased, so I wasn't rooting for a team at the time. But I did appreciate them as kind of one of the really great franchises in the NFL.
Well,
My favorite Giant was the guy I wrote a book with, is Jim Burt, who was a
okay.
nose tackle on the '86 team, and I wrote a book after that season, Hard Nose. It's the story of the '86 Giants.
That team, if I remember correctly, that team won the Super Bowl against my Broncos. Phil Simms got the highest percentage passing and won the MVP.
That's
And it
correct.
was at like 39 to 20, something like
Yes,
that.
39-20. Yeah.
I remember that one. That was the year before I started really paying attention to football, the way I do now. But I had a football card that had a picture of Phil Sims under center, and it talked about the game. I'm like, well, that started the Broncos off for having some bad luck until they
Yeah.
didn't.
Well, it's funny you should mention that Dan Reeves was the coach of that team. And later on he was a coach of the Giants. And that year I was coaching Little League baseball and we made it to the New Jersey State Finals. And the PR guy for the Giants was they used to put out clip packages for the guys. Well, it was in the newspapers every day. Now there are no newspapers, so they don't do that anymore. But he was putting my the coverage of my team on top of the clip package. So Dan was seeing it every day. And actually, we brought the team over there before we left, and he gave him a little pep talk. So we ended up losing in the last in the championship game. And I came back, and he said to me, "Hey, you guys made a hell of a run there." And I said, "Thank you, Dan, but I just can't win the big one."
Oh. If you don't know how
He
hard that
laughed.
must have hit, that's Dan Reeves in a nutshell. Probably one of the best coaches you'll ever meet, but he lost three with the Broncos and one with the Falcons.
He was a really good guy, passed away recently.
Now, he was a good
But
football player for the Cowboys, too.
oh, he was. Yeah, he idolized Tom Landry. He
Did
just
they win a
idolized.
Super Bowl with him, or they didn't?
Oh yeah.
They won one.
Yeah. He was also in the Ice Bowl. And he had the reminders of that, a scar on his lip. it was above his lip, actually. And he said he's reminded of the ice bowl every time he shaves.
Oh, I bet you he hit the ground. That ground must have been like rocked.
I think he threw a touchdown pass on a halfback option. He was a quarterback in college at South Carolina. But I love Dan. He was a great guy. So, I mean, he took it in good spirits. We laughed about that.
I'll tell you what. I'd love to have you back on to talk more of your football stories.
Sure.
You are a great guest, and I'm very grateful that you were gracious for me being. I feel absolutely awful, or I would talk longer.
That's
Again, we'll
okay. You
put.
get better, and we'll do it again. We can talk a little bit about the Jim Burke book as well.
Please, please. 1986 had a team, Mark Bavaro, of course, Lawrence Taylor. You had a whole lot of players. No, it was Bavaro in 86.
Yeah, he was on 86. That's the year he carried all those 49ers on his back on
Yes,
Monday
it
Night.
was that, and that 49ers game was the Super Bowl. I believe it was the NFC Championship game or a divisional game, but that was the Super Bowl.
Well, that was actually a regular season game. That was played Thanksgiving weekend.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was the Monday night game of that Thanksgiving weekend, and they ended up playing them again in the playoffs.
What
But
game was it that the Giants knocked out Montana, which gave Young the starting role?
Well, that was there were two of them. Jim Burt knocked him out in the playoffs in '86, and then Leonard Marshall knocked him out.
That's what I was thinking of.
And another one, he didn't fare too well with the Giants.
No, you couldn't get away with those hits. I think Marshall went high on that.
Jim Burt actually visited Montana in the hospital that night.
Oh, he felt bad about it.
But
They
he
just
felt
wanted to
bad
check
about
on
it.
him.
Jim Burt was another good guy. I still see him. I played golf with Bavaro a couple of years ago.
That dude, I think there's a recording of Bill Parcells saying he didn't want to fight Mark Bavaro.
That's right, Bavaro.
If you want to see what a tight end of the 80s looked like, Bavaro is that guy. He's not flashy, but he would do everything that you can think about.
Absolutely. He's a guy that you would go to war with for certain and
And away off the subject, and I thank you for tolerating this. What I've seen about Bavaro, and I watched him growing up, and I played Tecmo Bowl, and he was there. He was not the flashy Kelce or Kittles type of guy. But he was the kind of guy that if he blocked you, you were on your hind end.
Oh yeah, he was a great blocker. He was
And
a
that's the point. It was a very run heavy offense that could pass. And you couldn't have a run heavy offense in the 80s without a Tom Rathman, a fullback, or a Bavaro who was a tight end. You just couldn't have that.
He did the things that other people wouldn't do, but I think he should be in the Hall of Fame. I know his career was short, cut short by injury and everything, but I think for pure tight ends, I don't think he'd get any better than
So was Sterling Sharpe. So was Terrell Davis. So was Glenn or Gale Sayers. If you made a difference that people knew who you were for a short period of time, it doesn't matter if it's 3 or 4 years. If that was you were the pinnacle, you should be considered, my
I'll tell you a
opinion.
funny story about Bavaro. So as he was sliding kind of at the end of his career with the Giants, I wrote a takeout piece on it, and how he wasn't really the player he had been. And I didn't write the headline, but the headline was From Rambo to Bambi, because if you remember, his nickname was Rambo. So it was
Oh.
Rambo. So when I played golf with him a couple of years ago, I was on the putting green, and we're talking about, because he never talked to the media, right? He just clammed up. You couldn't get anything out of him. Now you can't shut him up, but then you couldn't get anything. So we're on the putting green, and I said, "Yeah, we got, we had a decent relationship." He says, "Yeah, until you wrote that Ram." He remembered. He says, "Until you wrote that Rambo to Bambi story." You don't want to
Please
mess
tell
with
me.
him. He still looks like he can play a little bit
Please
too.
tell me he still has that head of hair.
Yeah, he does, and he still has those guns for arms. So,
Some people have all the luck, as you can tell. Some people have
but
all the luck.
again, another great guy. A lot of great guys on the '86 team. I keep in touch with a lot of them.
Well,
So.
when you get back on here and I'll get in contact with you, let's talk about that. But right now, I
Oh, can I
appreciate
mention
you.
one more thing?
Yeah, absolutely.
I have a book out now. The current book is on it's I because I covered golf as well as football, and it's called Ryder Cup Rivals. It's I did 13 short stories on kind of the Ryder Cups that mattered, that kind of set the tone for the whole series. So that's out now. It's gotten very good reviews. So if you're a golf fan as well, check that out, Ryder Cup Rivals.
I will put that on the show notes as well. I am not a golf fan, so I know what the Ryder Cup is, but I'm not a golf fan. So there are a couple on the Sports History Network that are that write about and that does podcasts about golf. So we could probably get you in touch with some people that can talk
Yeah,
about
that would
that.
be great. I would love that. I'm doing a bunch of podcasts now, so
Well, it's fun, isn't
anyway,
it?
I'm up for anything.
It's a lot of fun. The podcasting to me is a lot of fun because you can talk and you can have a good time. But right now, I want to thank you for coming on and for understanding. We've had to change a little bit of timing here and we finally got to talk and I enjoyed every bit of it. Thank you, Mr. Hank.
Thank you, Jeremy. Feel better, please. Get well soon.
Thank you. And y'all, thank you for listening to the Football's Family Podcast.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, aka the Football History Dude, and I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history. But as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know, that can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you gotta do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you gotta do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.